Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, this is episode 2. Thank you so much to everyone who got in touch following our launch and episode 1, in which I spoke to the wonderful Dr. Jo Mitchell, psychologist and director of the Mind Room in Melbourne, Australia. If you haven't heard that interview, Jo and I explored the challenges of perfectionism, asked the question, how do high performers differ from you and I? Hint, it has to do with their mindset. And Jo shared her simple tips for happiness and how she implements these in her life. You can download Jo's tip sheet at potential.com.au/podcast. Today, I'm very excited to welcome parenting and e-safety expert Martine Oglethorpe to the podcast. Martine works with students and parents through schools and other organisations to help them safely and smartly incorporate technology into their lives. She also works with teachers to explore how they can incorporate digital literacy into their classrooms. And Martine is a keynote speaker accredited by the Office of E-Safety Commission of Australia, and she's also a writer and a parent herself. Welcome, Martine.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You are very welcome. I'm excited that you're here because I've got lots of cool stuff that I'd like to talk to you about in relation to e-safety and the cyber world and kids and parenting.
Excellent.
As a mother, parent of primary school age kids myself, I think I battle with the challenges and the anxiety surrounding screen time and social media and online relationships probably as much as anyone else. Mm-hmm. But what I love about your approach and your message is its positivity. You're not kind of doling out rules and restrictions around screen time or telling people to be fearful of what could happen. And I know there's a lot of that in the media and a lot of that, I think, particularly I see it amongst parents online. And you have quite a different take on it. Tell our listeners about your take on this world.
Yeah, well, I guess when we come from a place of fear, it's not very empowering or very helpful for parents because it doesn't allow us to really tackle the problem or tackle the challenges in a constructive or positive way, which is really what our kids need. So I think we get very scared about the technology because it's often in a realm that we don't really understand as parents, or we're coming from it from a very different angle that our children are. But I think we need to remember what, you know, it fundamentally means to be a parent or a child hasn't changed today. You know, as parents, we want to keep our kids safe when they're young. We want to protect them, and we certainly need to be doing that. But then we also want to give them the skills and the behaviours and the thinking to go out into the world and be productive, independent, confident members of society. And so to do that, I think we need to, you know, remember we want to learn about this world because we have to, you know, it is a different playground to the one that we grew up in. So it's really important that we understand the playground so that we can, A, protect them when we need to and keep them safe, but also so that we have a good understanding of the good and the bad so that we can then give them those skills and the thinking and all of those behaviours that they're going to need when we're not going to be there to hold their hand, because we can't base our parenting in this space on shutting things down, blocking, banning, doing that sort of protection, because it's not going to serve our kids well. Because we know that they're going to be out in the world and doing a lot of this stuff independently of us being able to look up over their shoulder the whole time. So we need to make sure that we come to them with this.
So it's kind of an extension, I suppose, of just, you know, being a good parent generally across the board.
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's still just parenting. And that's why I don't say to parents, these are the rules you need to have. I don't stipulate all those sorts of things, because I think as parents, we have our own values and things that are important to us. And we need to be making those decisions ourselves. But what I do help parents with is understanding what's out there for their children so that they know that this is the way that they can interact. These are sorts of challenges that they face. These are the mistakes that they will probably make, so that then you can then go in and parent the way that you see fit and incorporate that technology in a way that's going to work for your family. And I guess then basing that on the communication that you have with your child and make sure that's the focus still.
Yeah, I think that's really, really interesting. I think particularly your point about, being able to kind of work out what works for your family. I think that's one of the challenges I always see with any of the rigid rules or, you know, guidelines that are provided, the 2 hours of screen time maximum limit and concerns that people have about, you know, what kids should and shouldn't watch. And you know, every family is so different. Every child is different. You know, I have two sons. One really could spend a bit of time online. He loves watching his sports on YouTube, but other than that, you know, gets bored and wants to go outside and do something. The other one is, you know, six and he's in a world of Minecraft doing what I think is kind of amazing. And the things he tells me that he learns, and I kind of battle with that, you know, should they spend so much time, particularly someone so small, should it be doing that? And then I look at what he's doing and I think, wow, this is, you know, kind of cool. And I parent them differently. So I guess you're saying, you know, here's some guidelines, or what you like to help educators, parents with, is here's some guidelines for you to perhaps apply to your family.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, we can all have our own family rules like we do with everything. You know, some people aren't allowed to watch certain movies, or they're not allowed to have a lot of sugar, or they all have to go to church on Sunday. I mean, everybody has their family rules that are just what is important to them. And I think, you know, parenting in this space is no different either. What's important to you, but also what's going to work, as you said, for your individual child. When we tend to have some blanket rules, we're forgetting that children deal with this space very differently. And, you know, for some children, they can happily play Minecraft or happily engage in social media and have no ill effects from it. In fact, you know, become away more positive. And there are other children that, you know, maybe it's not such a positive experience for them. So we need to be looking a lot more closely at the experiences our children are having with the technology, and then decide on, you know, whether or not our boundaries are working for them, or whether we need to make some changes that way.
Okay. And what are the kind of questions you get from, because you actually go out there and speak to parents, both some in their workplaces, is that right? And also via schools?
Yeah. So I guess the main thing parents are often, I guess, one of the things that they're worried about is how much time, that question. So how much time should my 6-year-old have? How much time should my 8-year-old, and how much time should my 12-year-old? And I think we need to get smarter with our questioning and then how much time, because we know that our kids are using the technology to engage in so many different ways, as are we as adults, and we'll continue to in the future. So I think we need to look at questions rather than simply just the amount of time. What are they doing with that time, and what are they doing with the screen? So looking at questions like, are they merely consuming? Are they, you know, hours on end just consuming content that may be positive for them or may not be, or it may be helpful in education, educational and relevant, or it may be untrue and fake and not helpful. So looking at what are they consuming, or are they doing lots of consuming and none of the creative or interactive stuff, which is what we know the benefits come from the technology when we're interacting with the technology and when we're creating with it. You know, we can't compare a child that may be playing, you know, hours and hours of Candy Crush, even though that can be valid for short periods of time for relaxation. But a child doing that, as opposed to a child, you know, creating a song on GarageBand or making a movie, or, you know, there's lots of different things that we're doing. And you know, a child that might be looking at YouTube videos to help their brother make a paper plane and find the best way to do it, or are they watching hardcore pornography? I mean, they're completely completely different uses of their time and of the technology and the effects that it's having on them. So it's important that we look at those questions, and also are they having a good time on the technology? We want to, you know, sometimes say they're on social media all the time. That's okay if it is uplifting them, if they are being inspired by other people, if they are making positive connections and it is reinforcing those friendships that already exist. But if it's not, if it's, you know, if it's messing with their self-esteem, if they're constantly comparing themselves to everyone, they're feeling excluded, you know, if they're getting bullied, I mean, then they're not having a great time with the technology. So we need to look at not just how much time, but what are our kids doing with the technology, and is it adding to their life, or is it taking it away, and how can we then go and nurture those elements that we want to give them more positive experiences.
And I guess that's why parents really do need to understand the technologies, need to be involved. I know in conversations that I've had, because I'm quite active on social media myself and I'm engaged in the online area because that's part of what I do, you know, for my work. But I know a lot of parents who don't engage in any social media. They find it scary and they find it then confronting. And I wonder if you're not involved, how much you can actually be keeping an eye out, I suppose, and really being critical in assessing what your children are doing and how they're doing it and what impact it's having on them.
Yeah, absolutely. And this sort of stuff, you know, can happen when our children are really young, when we're sitting them on our laps with an iPad and watching an episode of something of Peppa Pig or whatever it is, or reading a story together. We can still get that very interactive element of reading a book together with them. Just because it's on a screen doesn't mean we can't ask them questions about what's going to happen, what do they think's going to happen, what character do they like, all those sorts of things. It starts with that interaction. And then as they go on, obviously we're not going to be sitting with them 24/7 while they're on their screens. But it does allow us to see the sorts of things that they're doing so that we can ask the right questions and get them to start thinking critically. You know, when they sit, we see something on our own feeds or on their feeds that's questionable, or, you know, we can ask those questions. Do you think that person meant to say that? Or, you know, do you think that's the way they wanted to come across? Because, you know, with no tone of voice, we could take that the wrong way. And just getting them to think critically about what they're looking at, and how do we know that this is true? How do we know that this is not fake? What's the language used in this article? You know, who's reading it? Why was it written? Who else is supporting it? What's their data to back it up? And we have to be able to ask those questions with them, because if we sit them down and try and lecture them on, you know, understanding and evaluating content, it's a little bit, well, A, they're probably going to stop listening to you pretty quickly. But if we're doing it in a way that we're reading something together, or we've read something and we think, what do you think of this? How would you interpret it? It allows them to start thinking more critically, and being involved, we can then see what their challenges are going to be. And, you know, we also want to remain, I guess, a bit relevant to our kids. You know, when I've had kids where things have gone wrong, or they found themselves in trouble online, and I say to the child, why did you feel you couldn't go to mum or dad? And the answer is always because they wouldn't understand.
Yeah.
They would tell me to shut it down. They would tell me to close the account. They would tell me, why would you want to be engaging in that if this is how it ends up? And they would say, in my day, we used to go outside and we'd ride billy carts and we'd talk to our friends face to face and all those wonderful things that we used to do.
Yeah.
But we also have to understand that it's not relevant for their world at the moment. They only
and that
know
shuts
world.
The conversation down, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, it doesn't open it up and give you an opportunity to have a parenting conversation.
Building up that, you know, that wall between them and us. You know, it's even though the technology, sometimes we know, you know, it can be a real bane of our existence because it's frustrating and it does seem tend to take control sometimes. We don't want to make it the bad guy as such, because when we do that, we are setting up those that us versus them kind of mentality. And we want to keep that open in that, you know, we can still have rules and boundaries around it, but these are why, and these are the challenges that I see for you. This is why I think I need to have some of these boundaries around it, or this is why we need to have this discussion about what's out there, because, you know, that it's not always appropriate for you, and they're often playing in playgrounds that weren't created for young people. So we need to be there to help them, you know, with those conversations and make sure that, you know, they can come to us, and that, you know, they know that, you know, if they make mistakes, we are there, because they will make mistakes.
Yep.
But we want them to be those little mistakes that they can learn from, and things that they can get over and are not going to be life altering, which
that build their resilience. Yeah,
absolutely. And we want to help them with that too.
Yeah. And that context, that why, you know, I've actually had some conversations both with clients and with others in the last week or so about the importance of providing that why, if we want people to change their behavior, that saying do this or do that isn't enough. People don't, you know, none of us do. We just, you know, our instant thought is, well, why shouldn't I? Exactly. And if you've got an even tiny bit of a rebellious streak, and most of our kids have got that, because that's part of learning to push their boundaries, you know, they'll kind of go, well, why? I'm going to do it anyway. Instead of us explaining, you know, this is what I do or don't want you to do, and this is why I think it's a good idea, and unpacking that with them.
Yeah. And I've had that experience with, you know, I had a dad once who was desperate to get his child off Minecraft, because, you know, it was just, he just saw it as something that he didn't need to be doing all of the time. And I said, you know, why do you need him to get off? He goes, because he can't, you know, he's going to turn into a zombie and he's going to do this or this. I said, how about you have a game with him? Because I want you to understand what he loves about it, so that then you can make the boundaries around it coming from a place of knowledge and understanding, rather than simply, it looks like it's got to be bad for you, so I'm going to shut it down.
Yeah.
And when he did play that game, not only did he see that there were some amazing skills his son was getting and had already learned, it also gave them some bonding time, but it allowed his son to teach him some things as well. Mm-hmm. And that's great as well, that there's that toing and froing of knowledge as well. He could then go and put in place some boundaries by saying, I know you love this and I get why you love it. And, you know, you're going to be allowed to use it, but we're going to put some boundaries around it because there's lots of other things that you need to fit into your day and lots of other ways that you need to learn and interact and have fun. And this is great, and it's just one element of it, though, and we need to fit other things in. So it's about framing it in a way that yes, I get that you like it, but, you know, we need to make boundaries for these other reasons. And, and, you know, we have to look at also what we're replacing it with too. I had another father who wanted to get his son off Minecraft, said to me, I finally got him down. He's only allowed 20 minutes a day. And I said, well, what does he do when you get him off? He goes, well, he goes and watch telly. And I said, well, so you just create, you know, one screen for another. And I don't know what he was watching, but, you know, probably nothing that was, you know, giving him a lot of benefit either.
No.
So we've got to look at all of those things as well. And if we understand what they're doing and you know, and take an interest in it as well, we're going to have a lot more success making some of those boundaries.
Mm. And I love that you're encouraging critical thinking, both for the kids themselves around what they're doing, how they're doing it, how they're interacting with other people, what other people might be thinking, feeling, all of that, but also critical thinking for parents to realize that this stuff is far more nuanced. You know, we've gone, I suppose, you know, there's been a massive leap in technology and technological changes, even, you know, in my lifetime, from when I was at university where there wasn't any internet, that's how long ago it was, to today where we're parenting in an environment where these things are popping up, new technologies, new online platforms are popping up every day. Kids are, you know, I've got a 9-year-old and he and his friends are all talking about the YouTube channels that they're going to start. So, you know, it's been a big change for a generation of parents to come across all of this, but starting to think critically about, you know, what's involved and what kids could get from it.
Yeah. And everything they're doing as well. And you're right when you say it's far more nuanced than other areas of our life have been. You know, for example, we can all say to kids, oh, you must be kind online, you know, be kind and don't bully people. Well, you know, that's obviously very true. And we certainly want that. But there's a whole lot of ways that we interact that are a lot more nuanced than that. And it's not just about not being or being unkind or bullying. It's about how do I respond when somebody makes a comment that I think is not bullying, but it's not nice or it's questionable. Or what does it mean when I like someone else's post who has said something that may be excluding somebody else? How am I implicated in that?
Yeah.
What does it mean when I'm involved in a group chat with my mates and I can tell that they're starting to talk about somebody that, you know, that person wouldn't like if they were involved or knew that? So there's all of those sort of grey areas. What does it mean when I have a comment that I don't know how to interpret because there's no tone of voice, there's no facial expression?
These are struggles for adults too, aren't they?
Absolutely.
I mean, these are the same thoughts that I know. I'm like, oh, yes, I've been in that situation and, oh, yes, I know that sometimes somebody posts something that is unfortunate and then you click like and you go, well, I don't like the content. You know, I don't like that this has happened to you, but I want to kind of show a level of support. So,
and all of those areas are very complex. And as you say, complex for adults, so certainly complex for children who are often hanging out in a lot of these spaces that they're really not socially, emotionally, developmentally ready for as well. So there's all of those sorts of questions of readiness and the maturity and things like that, that they have to start learning a lot of those skills a lot earlier than you or I would have, because it was pretty simple in the playground. You know, you said something nasty or you didn't and you kind of moved on. And whereas
and you got that facial expression or you got the instant feedback.
You can read and things do get forgotten about a lot more quickly. Whereas online, we know those things hang around a lot longer. So the effects of when things go wrong or we say the wrong thing or, you know, or somebody says the wrong thing about us, the effects are a lot more lasting because they do tend to hang around, you know, a lot longer. So we sort of feel that more. It's the same thing when, you know, we hear about a party that, you know, we weren't invited to in our day. You know, we got a bit sad and we would have liked to have gone to the party, but we weren't invited. Today, these kids have to sit there and scroll through their feed on a Saturday night and see everybody else that's at the party, you know, when they weren't there. So those sorts of resilience skills we need to be, you know, instilling as well, because there's not a lot we can do about that. That's part of our life at the moment. And again, some kids are firmly over that and they get, yep, this is part of our life. we have to deal with this. It's the way it is. Whereas other kids who, you know, are not so robust and not so resilient take all those things a lot more to heart, and the effect is a lot more because A, they're reading it and seeing it over and over again, and also they know that lots of other people are seeing it as well. We have to sort of be in tune to our own individual children as well and their needs. Mm,
absolutely. And how do kids respond to this stuff when you're talking in schools or in classrooms, you know, with kids? And I'm guessing what sort of age ranges would you talk about this?
All right through. So I'd start, I can start with right the bottom of the primary school. So they're little preppies or foundations. And that's obviously just a lot more basic cyber safety. So that, you know, it's just reinforcing some of the safety elements more for them is keeping them safe online. Then going through primary school level, whilst parents and teachers don't often like to admit it, but this is when they are getting involved in some social media. So particularly that middle primary to upper primary, I do a lot more of those online behaviours. How do we respond when somebody says something that we don't like or we can't interpret? You know, what are the sorts of questions we need to be asking of ourselves when we start talking to somebody? You know, how do we know this person is who they say they are? All of those sorts of things. And at the primary school level, yeah, they're pretty malleable and they're pretty open to all of that sort of stuff. And that's why I think it's a great age to get them, because it is before they've formed a lot of those habits and thinking that, you know, by the time they're in high school, they're off doing their own thing, often got their second Instagram account. we can't keep as much of an eye on them, so therefore we're not teaching them as well either. So that's why I think it's crucial that particular middle upper primary that they start thinking about for those times when they're going to start interacting. Because as I said, they're often starting to do it, but they're not quite there yet. And this often comes about in an example I share with kids where a young girl was on Musical.ly and started talking to who she believed was Justin Bieber. He asked her for a nude photo in return. He would come and play at her school. She'd be really popular. Now, unfortunately, she did send that photo. The second time he asked, that feeling was inside her that this isn't right. So thankfully she got help from mum, and this guy, particular guy, was prosecuted. But when I bring this up as an example for children to think of, how would you know he was who he says he was? How do we know anybody's who they say they are online? And, you know, some kids, particularly when you're looking at celebrities, they have a fairly good understanding of some of the things they can do. They can see if that particular person is verified. They can see how many followers they have. If they've got millions, it's probably the real deal. If they've got 38, it's not going to be.
Yeah.
So they can look at some of those critical thinking quite well. But then they also remind me every time that they're often not quite there developmentally either, because they will say things like, well, I would ask Justin Bieber what is the name of his first rap was, because not many people know that. Or I read once what his first dog's name was, or I knew the suburb he grew up in, or the first, you know, these are stuff that most people don't know. And so it's realizing that, yeah, you're just not there yet to ask some of those questions that you need to ask. So that's why I think it's critical that that parents are on board at this stage when they're starting to dabble in social media and online interactions, because we need to help them with those questions and get them to ask, how do we know this person is who they say they are? How do we know that, you know, this is going to be read the right way, and all those sorts of things? And we need to be there for. So primary school, they're certainly still, they're great, and because it's an area that they're sort of starting to dabble in, they want to learn more about it. It's
relatively new.
Yeah, they want to understand it. I guess by the time you're looking at upper secondary, they're all over it. They know all this stuff. There's not much you can teach them, but there is still certainly elements of it that they need help with. And you can see sometimes the eyes light up at certain moments. And it's those moments that, you know, yeah, you've been in this situation, and it's giving them the tools of how to handle certain situations. And also many of them look very, you know, act very cool, and you know, there's a lot of bravado going on. You can see behind the eyes there's a little flicker of, oh, yeah, that's what happened to me once. Yeah. Or that's what I saw happen. This is how maybe I could handle it better. So it's just trying to also open that up to say, you know, I know that you're there and you're using this stuff every day, but you're going to encounter, you know, situations that you may need help with as well, or you may want to think about how you respond in future differently so it's a better outcome for you.
And I suppose too, I mean, just as you're saying that, I was thinking, you know, if trying to connect or make that connection with teens who are already, you know, too cool for school and they know it all, et cetera, and perhaps even, you know, for me, just thinking, you know, this is stuff that I struggle with, making, I suppose, you know, the kids realize that adults, you know, it's new for adults too. They struggle with the nuances of these kind of complex interactions that we have, even face to face, let alone online. So they're not alone in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's just making them aware of that too, that, you know, this is an area that everybody struggles with, and most people look like they're doing okay online. Sometimes they're not. So it's getting them to think about those sorts of things as well, that it's, you know, it's often we're only seeing one part of somebody's experience or their life, and we need to, you know, get them to look beyond that as well.
One of the things that obviously there's been a lot of press across the world, but particularly in Australia, in relation to cyberbullying and the link to some tragic suicides that have been documented even in recent months here. I mean, we've talked about the complexity of human behaviour generally, let alone human behaviour that is then created in an online forum where we don't get some of the feedback that we get when we're seeing people face to face. What's your advice, I suppose, or your tips for parents who are really concerned? Because I know there's a lot of parents who are really concerned.
Yeah. Well, I guess number one is be active and involved as much as you can in what they're doing. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to go and read all of their, you know, all their messages and all their chats. You know, certainly when they're young and starting out, you can do that, I think, because, you know, they, as I say, that's when they're learning. But as they get older, I guess it's alerting yourself to some of those red flags and, you know, that we would look for in normal bullying circumstances. You know, are they becoming a bit more reclusive? Are they, you know, they not coming to the dinner table and eating and being themselves? Are they not still engaging in friends the way that they used to, or extracurricular activities? All of those things, you know, we want to sort of keep on top of. But again, it's just keeping those lines of communication open and I guess, you know, not threatening to shut down the technology.
Yeah.
All of those sorts of things, because we don't want them to not come to us with those sorts of concerns because they're afraid of shutting it down and feeling even more isolated or more excluded or feeling, you know, that they're going to be bullied even more. So we want to sort of make sure that we're, yeah, doing what we can to keep those lines of communication open, making sure that they're not going to get in trouble if they're having challenges online, because, you know, it's, you know, we don't want that to be a reason why, you know, they go and experience a lot of this stuff themselves. I talk to kids about who's that one person that you can go to, you know, preferably an adult, but if it's a child and you happen to be a child that someone would come to, what do you do then? What are the sorts of steps that you could do? So in all of my classes that I talk to the kids, I make them sit for a minute and think of that one person that they can go to who they think is not going to, you know, they're not going to get in trouble from them. And what are the steps that they think might be taken from them to make them realize that there are steps that we can take. Certainly, making them recognize the difference between what's just mean and nasty and drama as opposed to what is bullying is important too, because we have laws against bullying, and we want them to know that there are things that can be done, and there's a process that can happen. And, you know, we have the eSafety Commission now it makes it very clear and easy on how you can report somebody for bullying. And certainly going to your social networks is the first port of call. You know, we report and we can block, always checking your settings for any of those places where that might be happening. Go to your settings, you can report, you can block people. If they're still coming from you, if nothing's been done about that from the social network point of view, then we can go to places like the eSafety Commission and get those things looked at, because they do have the power now to look at those things. So it's important that they know that there is somewhere for them to go, and that they're not alone, and that, you know, things can happen to change, you know, the experience that they're having. So really important, I guess, just to keep that, you know, those lines of communication open with our kids, that, you know, something can be done. It's certainly not something that they need to put up with or should put up with either.
Yeah. And how do they define, I mean, I know for me as a psychologist, and I talk about workplace bullying in workplaces, but how is bullying, I suppose, defined versus just bad behaviour or, you know, being mean?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think there is a lot of meanness that happens online, certainly with adults as well. You know,
it's human, have to look sadly. Yep.
And so there's a lot of that, I guess, meanness and drama that gets created. So it might be just somebody not involving you in a group chat, or it might be somebody making a comment about something that you've worn, or, you know, and it might be a one-off comment. So it's mean and nasty, but it's not something that's ongoing. It's not something that there's a real power play. You know, we usually say there's the three things in bullying that there is. There's a power play. Somebody has more power over another person. Mm-hmm. There is behavior that is ongoing, and that it doesn't stop when we ask it to stop. So if I say, please stop, and it doesn't stop, or if I've blocked you and you create another account and come at me from another account, If you come at me on different platforms when I've shut down a certain platform because I want to get away from you, if you come at me from somewhere else, that's bullying because it's that repeated and ongoing contact. And, you know, if it's done with the intent to cause me hurt or embarrassment, you know, if I'm sharing a video of you that I know is going to embarrass or hurt you and I'm doing it, you know, then that is bullying as well. Yeah. It's probably having those three elements. Mm-hmm. And you know, I guess at the end of the day also, some of those behaviors, some people can handle a lot more than others as well. Yeah. So it's also working out what's, you know, what do I need to be resilient about and hopefully, you know, let it run off my back. But what is it that's, this is not something that I need to just be resilient about. This is something that needs to stop because it's not fair and it's not something I can or should put up with.
Yeah, and I guess the flip side of that resiliency is teaching kids empathy as well, teaching them that, you know, just because something doesn't necessarily seem mean or particularly, you know, aggressive to them doesn't mean that everybody is the same, that everybody has the same capacity to deal with comments or thoughts. You know, we all have different levels of resilience. And I know, again, that's something I teach adults in workplaces. Yep. So, you know, trying to teach kids that this is human behavior.
And, you know, I guess all of those things like those, what we call those soft skills, our empathy, all those sorts of things, they are starting to get looked at a lot more in schools, which is great. Mm. Obviously needs to happen even more, but because these are the skills that they're going to need going forward because, you know, this is a world that they're going to inhabit right throughout. And so we want them to start learning those skills and that empathy and all of those sorts of things while they're young so that they take it with them and that those, you know, habits become behaviors that then just become what they do. The earlier we can start with that, the better, because then we don't have to do it so much when we're adults in a workplace.
Yeah, and it hopefully reduces a lot of that bullying type behaviour. I do really get the sense, and I don't know what your take on this is, but I do get the sense that there's a kind of a cohort of kids at the moment who have grown up with the very early days, a lot of these technologies where there wasn't a whole lot of understanding. And perhaps these kids now are in their late teens or maybe early 20s, maybe they're even older than that. And that the younger kids now are coming, you know, they are getting that education in school. They're talking about e-safety. We're talking about topics like empathy and respect and the importance of values and these sorts of things that certainly didn't get discussed in schools in my time. Yeah. And it's these middle kids, these kids who are sort of that are perhaps struggling the most. And maybe I'm just being overly optimistic.
No, I agree. You know, that when it happened very quickly, you know, it's suddenly, you know, we had this technology, we had the internet, and then these devices started coming through our schools and we handed out, you know, devices with BYOD programs and with not a lot of thought. Is certainly not like it happens today. You know, our programs are so much more thought out and we have so many more things in place to try and protect our kids, but also to give them skills as well. And the parents themselves, they weren't given the same sorts of instruction that we're giving today because it happened very quickly and we didn't know what the result was going to be. We still don't know a lot of the effects, obviously, but we have a lot more knowledge and a lot more research now to know the sorts of ways that we can deal with these things. And there was a, you know, that cohort of parents that have, you know, where their kids have already gone through, they probably struggled a lot more. I think kids today are probably in the best position to get this stuff right. Our kids coming to our primary schools now are getting some great instruction on how to deal with this place and how to develop those skills that they're going to need going forward. And I see a lot of them doing some amazing things with the technology.
Yeah.
It in wonderful, positive ways, and a lot more positive than a lot of the adults, you know.
Yes.
and interacting in ways that are a lot more positive than a lot of adults are doing. So I think, you know, and again, maybe a little bit optimistic, but I'm certainly from what I see in schools as well, that kids, you know, they want to get all the good stuff out of the technology. They want to experience all that great stuff. And us helping them with that is certainly helping them, you know, have those good experiences. And if you're having a good experience with something, if you're focusing on the great stuff that you can do, if you're being a leader with the technology and using it in ways that, you know, is inspiring or you know, creating or doing whatever it is that you're doing that's positive, you don't have as much time to get involved in some of those negative elements.
Yeah.
And you know, some of those other elements of it don't play such a big role because you're not so focused on comparing yourself to what everyone else is doing or feeling excluded or, you know, are you looking the right way you should be looking and all those sorts of things. You're focused on doing some great stuff with it, then that's what your focus is and that's where we need to lead our kids as well.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful point, because I know, you know, for me as a psychologist, particularly as a positive psychologist, a lot of what we know about that contributes to well-being and mental health are things like having positive emotion, which they're getting if they're having fun, being engaged in our tasks, so having that kind of real level of mental engagement where you're stimulated and you're excited and you're learning. And it can contribute to that. Relationships, I think I do see, and whilst it's the negative things like the bullying that gets a lot of press and a lot of discussion, I personally, you know, my son, 9-year-old, who has a second cousin, my cousin's son, who lives in Edinburgh, and they sort of made a bit of a connection at Christmas time when they were here together, and they realized that they're able to contact each other and actually talk to each other through their devices, you know, in a way that never could have or would have happened. So they can build relationships which extend beyond their immediate circle, and we know that's really good for mental health and well-being.
Absolutely. And even, you know, there are some kids that are isolated, whether it's socially, geographically, all those sorts of things. And, or it might just be that they have some, you know, quirky thing that they're interested in that somebody else, you know, across the globe is interested in. And those connections can be really, really valuable for those kids. And, and we do sometimes dismiss a lot of those benefits because we hear so much in the media about the negative interactions. And yes, there's predators out there, and yes, there's bullying out there, but there's also some ways people are making great connections. You know, certainly as adults, we know some of the great connections that we've made from the online world for our own work, but also friendships that have developed. And we have to remember that that's going to happen for our kids as well. So again, teaching them how to make good, you know, good relationships and to have, you can have your boundaries around your friendships online and all those sorts of things. But I can, you know, we are seeing research now that's showing that there are some real positives to those connections that can be made online as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Martine, how did you get interested in this particular field? Because you have a background in education and a master's in counselling.
Yeah.
And you are also the mother to 5 boys, is that right?
Yeah. Boys,
so how did you get involved in this area?
Well, I guess always had an interest in education. I was a secondary teacher. Then I went back and did my master's in counselling because I guess I always felt that I loved helping people. I loved understanding how people worked, and I loved, you know, understanding behaviours. And then I guess having 5 children of my own, I wanted to understand them as well.
Yes.
But then I started doing some youth counselling. That was sort of an area that I was interested in. But I also found what I really wanted to do often when I was talking to young people was to talk to the parents. And the particular place I was at the time didn't really allow that. There was a lot of confidentiality things, and it was, no, you're here to serve the child. It's not a family situation. And I just felt that I had so much that I could offer parents in terms of, because of listening to their children and what I thought that their children needed. And a lot of it did seem to be about this gap, you know, with what parents understood about the world their children were growing up in. And obviously a lot of that was around technology and how it was used in the home. And so I started doing a lot of research in the area. I started my blog, so I started writing. Some of it was just general parenting, but I found I just kept going towards this technology stuff, and it was an area that fascinated me and that I also knew I needed to learn about, having 5 children of my own, that it was going to be something that was going to play a big role in our family, and I wanted to make sure that I had the best understanding of it. So I did a lot of research and then realised that I could offer a lot to families because of that knowledge of what they were doing and what it was capable of, but also of the challenges that our kids were going to face. So I guess I just wanted to get out there and work with the parents, and then also work with the kids as well to let them know that, we as adults can get it too, and we're here to help you. Because, you know, we know that you've got the tech stuff down pat. You know, you can upload and download and do all of that sort of stuff, but it's some of those behavioural things that they need help with. So I wanted to get in and help them, and then also with teachers as well, because you know, the technology is fast becoming very much of their lives and of their teaching, and they've got so much that they need to be on top of and all over. And so I sort of felt that was an area that I could help them with as well, in understanding the technology and how it affects the children in their classroom, how what goes on, you know, after hours can be brought into the classroom, and how they can manage those sorts of things as well.
Yeah, and I assume try and reduce some of the perhaps fear around it, particularly for the parents and the teachers, I'm guessing, as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, there are some teachers that are, you know, are great in this space, and they've been brought up with it, and they're wanting to incorporate it in the best way possible. But then we also have those teachers who, you know, are coming from a lot of that more fear-based as well, or it's something that they've done without for a long time, so they don't really see the need for it to be incorporated as well. So it's trying to help them move a little bit as well and try and avoid some of that anxiety about it.
And how do you implement some of this stuff in your own home with your own family?
Well, certainly looking at my individual children, and I have a 17, nearly 18-year-old down to a 6-year-old. So obviously, there are certain rules and boundaries that are different for each child, depending on their developmentally and where they are, but also, what their needs are. Some can, pick it up and put it down and it's not a worry. Others might get a little bit more engrossed in it. So I might have to look at putting, different boundaries on them because I feel, if a game, for example, seems to be getting out of hand, I might say, okay, you can pull it back a little bit or make sure that you're managing the other areas in your life as well. So certainly looking at the individuals, but we also do, I guess, have some family rules that are just important to me and important to us as a family. And one of those is, no technology ever comes to the dinner table. And, we like to think that that would be standard practice in a lot of homes, but I know from my work out there that it's not.
It's not.
And
yeah.
I think it's crucial, that's one of the rules I do like to stipulate is that kids need that for the connection for family, but it also provides a really safe place for them as well, where if they are having struggles on, interactions they're having online, it gives them a break. It also makes them set some boundaries around their friendships and things like that, that they don't have to be accountable all the time to that group chat or answering that message. We want them to start putting some boundaries around that. We also want them to get into some good habits of eating a meal without having to check our phones, and that to be something that they take with them. And all of these things, when they happen from a young age, it just becomes what it is. So our kids just know now, it's just the devices don't come to the table. It's just what it is.
Yeah.
And we have that, all families have different rules around different things that are just what your family does. So that's probably one of the main rules that I would stipulate. Other things are different ages have different, whether or not they can have their devices in their room at night. The younger ones don't. Mm-hmm. The older ones, they're doing homework. Those rules change. So it's sort of just monitoring where each child is at and what their needs are at the time as well and the needs of the family.
And establishing family norms, I suppose that's what it is, isn't it? Having those conversations about what it is that we value as a family that even little kids can participate in, and then how we kind of enact that. And if it is things like, and I know I remember listening to, it was one of the psychiatrists, I think from the eating disorders unit at Westmead Hospital years and years ago, saying that family dinner, it didn't even have to be dinners. It was like the best protective factor for all sorts of, it was eating disorders, but he said, other problematic behaviours that kids might engage in over time, that eating 5 family meals together a week was one of the best things that you could do for your kids and for your family as they grow up, having that opportunity to talk and to share. And really, when you think about it, 5 is not that many over the course of a week when you can breakfasts, lunches and dinners.
Yeah. That's right. And the research is, as you would know, there is lots of research out there that backs that up. And I know for my own kids too, when they first walk in the door, I ask them how their day, I might get a bit of a grunt and and they're not ready. They're not ready to share. And they need that downtime to process, I guess, or just to relax or just not have mum in their ear wanting to find out all the finer details of their day.
Mm-hmm.
But I know when we come together as a family, and again, it's not every night because I might be working one night, they have things on, but if we aim for at least 3 family dinners and then, a few breakfasts together, it's at those times that things come out. That's when the stories come out. One child says something and it triggers something from another and before we know it, we're trying to
conversation.
We've got a conversation, and we've got to try, stop everyone from talking at once. But but those things don't happen if it's just, when they walk in the door, and we want to try and have it that way. So it's really important for that as well.
Absolutely. Martine, where can people find you if they're interested in learning more? I know you've got a blog that you write, and you write for other publications as well.
Yeah, I mean, you can find me all over the internet. I have a blog at themodernparent.net. I can also, I'm also on Facebook at The Modern Parent, Twitter, and so you can contact me on all those places. And I write regularly, or as regularly as I can, on my blog and for some other publications. I work just to do some work with Michael Gross from Parenting Ideas, and so you can find me there, or you can book me. As I said, I'm accredited by the eSafety Commission of Australia, so accredited to talk to schools, be it parents, teachers, students, but also do some corporate stuff as well, some lunch and learn and things like that for corporations to get their parents some help as well.
So schools and organisations can contact you through your website?
Yes.
Yep. Beautiful. Well, I will put all of those details and all of your social links in the show notes. But I really want to say thank you. Look, I have really enjoyed our conversation. As I said right at the beginning, one of the things that I have loved since I first met you and followed all of your activities is this understanding of the complexities of human behavior around the use of social media, but also this positive approach. It ties in really nicely with, you know, everything that I love and believe about positive psychology, that, you know, we need to kind of build things up in a positive way and engage in the conversations in order to embrace the change that happens, that shutting things down and that fear just tend to kind of close off the conversations, which I don't think is going to be good for parents, for adults, no, for kids and for families.
That's very true. That's the keeping the conversation open is what we need to do. And we have to have some of that understanding to be able to do that.
Yeah. So thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. And as I said, I'll put all of your contact details in the show notes, and anyone who's listening who wants to learn more from Martine and all of her wonderful work that she does can find her on the internet.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Loved it.
Wow. What a great conversation with Martine Oglethorpe from The Modern Parent. I found it reassuring, encouraging, and thought-provoking, and I hope you did too. I've provided a link to some of my favourite articles of Martine's in the show notes, and there you will also find a copy of Martine's tips for parenting and digital technology, as well as links to her website and social media presence. Don't forget that you can download Martine's tips from this episode too. It's all at potential.com.au/podcast. If you're keen to get hold of all of the free tips and resources that our guests offer podcast listeners, you can by signing up to my regular newsletter at potential.com.au/subscribe or follow the link on the homepage. And if you want every episode of the Potential Psychology podcast to appear like magic in your favourite podcast player, then please subscribe. In our next episode, I chat to Mel Schilling, psychologist and relationship coach. You might know her as one of the experts on Married at First Sight Australia. Here's a snippet of what Mel had to say.
Look, I have to admit, I may have one or two clients that every time they go on a date, they spend the first 2 minutes in the toilets doing their power pose.
It's a whole lot of fun. So join me next time when we'll uncover more tips for fulfilling your potential.